listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, we're going to be talking about integrative mastery for the positive transformation of you and your family. My guest today is Al Killian. Al has spent the last 35 years studying the human condition through the perspectives of individual cultures and traditions and the effects these traditions have on life, relationships, and business. He has successfully trained integrative leadership, management, and coaching skills to hundreds of individuals and organizational executives in dozens of major companies, including both Wells Fargo and RE/MAX. Al has just released his first book, Sole Proprietorship: The 8 Critical Steps to Overcoming Problems in Business and in Life. Al, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
Well, and we're glad to have you here. I had a chance to read. I'm about halfway into the book, and I'm really enjoying it. And I'm really enjoying the crossover of business into family life, where I know a lot of us, we have certain structure that we have for our business, and we structure our time, and we structure our employees, and we have a way in which we believe things should be done. And for some reason, we don't see the correlation. And I like the fact that you're touching on that, the correlation to how this affects your life and how it affects your family.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What I find in my work, Alan, with executives is there are a lot of people out there that have attained a lot of success in business, but oftentimes it comes at the cost of and with regret that they complain of life balance issues, or they maybe their kids grew up while they were busy at work or whatever. And it's always bothered me that there wasn't sort of a synthesis of how to approach all of the domains of our life, whether it's business or family or relationships or health or spirituality or whatever, with a certain consistent structure. So what I tried to set out to do in the book, based upon what I've learned in 10 years and 8,000 hours of coaching highly impactful people, is what are the common elements that need to be included to be effective in each of those domains with a certain consistency.
Well, and it certainly shows, again, as I'm reading it, it shows that you've obviously done some research, because I really liked where you were going with it. I was just thinking, when you were mentioning about executives and some of them that feel like they've missed that time with their kids, and it actually reminded me of a story with a particular gentleman who was a Fortune 500 CEO, and his child had run away, and so he contacted us to find his child. And when I got to the house, he was ranting and raving, and he was really upset. And he looks at me and he goes, "You're supposed to be the professional." He goes, "What the hell is that kid thinking, running out like this?" I said, I don't know. I don't have enough information to be able to tell you that right now. And he goes, "Well, I don't understand." He goes, "I've got X amount of people working for me, and I don't have this kind of problem there." But and he proceeded to tell me how he runs his business. And it was with an iron fist. And then he proceeds to say, "And that son of mine," he goes, "I've given him everything. Anything he's, before he can think about it, I've given it to him. And now he has the nerve to go do this." And I go, "Well, what would happen if you gave all your vice presidents whatever it was they wanted?" He goes, I don't know. And I go, "What would happen if you did that for about 6 months, and then all of a sudden you said, 'I'm taking it away. That's it. We're not going to have this anymore.'" And he goes, "Well, they'd probably quit." I go, "Well, maybe that's what your son's done." Mm-hmm. So it's that type of thing of being able to kind of get somebody to look at, look, this is how you're running this, but you're running your family completely differently. Maybe there's a way that you can mold some of this together, which is, again, is why I'm glad to have you here and why I'm glad that you've written the book that you have.
Well, thanks, Alan. And, you know, you bring an interesting point up because actually the way I work with business executives, and I'm blessed to currently be working with about 45 executives in 22 different companies. There are a lot of people out there these days that are looking for bigger answers in business and in personal relationships, in health, across the board. They want something that works a little better than perhaps they've found in their life thus far. And what I find with business executives, to your point, is that a lot of us were scripted back in the 20th century, particularly those of us that are old enough to remember the 50s and the 60s,
yeah,
to think that it all had to be managed with an iron fist. And yet, recent studies show, and some excellent work out of MIT's business school, Peter Senge and Keegan and Leahy out at Harvard, have determined that what the most effective approach to both business and, I believe, families isn't to necessarily control people with behavioral management, but rather to awaken a sense of significance and purposefulness and inspiration and passion and creativity and commitment in the people that we want to collaborate with. And if that's true in our relationships in business, I don't believe it's any more true in any area than it is in parenting, because most people in their final 5 minutes on the planet are going to be thinking about their children as the high watermark of important relationships. So we have to commit to effectiveness as parents in a altogether larger way than we often allow ourselves in other areas. And I believe the same rule applies, that we have to help a child develop a sense of future and a sense of passion and commitment and self. And I think there is a pathway to doing that with predictability and consistency that can maybe preclude some of the challenges that a lot of parents face with children today. And let's face it, a lot of children face with a very confusing world with a lot of options.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And again, having read part of the book, it sounds like you were touching on some of those critical steps to overcoming problems in family life. Why don't you go through them and just kind of break them down for us?
Yeah, I'd love to. And what I'll do, with your permission, is I'll just sort of do a 30,000-foot flyby and describe all eight at first, just in brief, and then I'll come back and we'll kind of dig into each one, if that works for you.
That works great.
Okay, so the eight critical steps that I've found, and by the way, I find most people, if they're not aware of all eight, only practice two of them, and we'll determine what those are as we go along. The eight critical steps are these. The first is mindset. Mindset refers to what our mindset, our attitude, is going to be when we approach problems. If we approach problems from a mindset of ego or our past scripts, we're really dooming the future to be merely a continuation or reflection of the past. What you mentioned with your CEO friend who was sort of bemoaning what happened with his son or his child and how he treats his employees, he really was articulating that he was approaching his business from a certain fixed premise that wasn't taking into account the needs, the desires, the wants of the people who worked for him. He just was telling them what they had to do to get to a result. But he was really obviating the possibility of their commitment. They simply had the only choice of complying or not complying. And if we treat children that way, that they're going to reach a point through the biological imperative of adolescence where they're going to basically decide, enough of this, I'm going to go out and find my freedom, and often in self-destructive ways. So the first category is mindset. We have a choice of approaching problems from either our ego or our values. Second is current reality analysis, which is to look at situations objectively rather than emotionally. Analyze the situation from what's working and what's not working rather than who's right or wrong. Mm-hmm. Because the moment we get into right or wrong issues, we intrinsically invite our ego or other people's egos to enter the battle, and we lose objectivity as to what the situation really looks like, and with it the commitment to effective resolution. Rather, we become territorial and protective of our particular perspective to kind of validate who we think we are as egos. So current reality analysis is step two, a very objective look at what is working or not working, what's effective or not effective. The third is future perfect outcome. We forget to dream. We forget to look forward at what's an ideal outcome to this situation, not just what kind of gets rid of my pain at this moment, but what would be a perfect outcome if I could imagine it. And to do that often raises the possibility of that outcome or some version of it eventuating. So we need to go ahead and dream forward in much more optimistic ways about what could happen. Why might this be a good thing? I'll share as a sidebar that 3 years ago, my wife and I, of 32 years, had a very challenging situation with our oldest son, who was in a very despondent, depressed place over the breakup of a long-term relationship, and he was suicidal. And we had to, I had to use these eight critical steps and my own values and my own personal life vision values to really influence the situation and look at it without knowing I could control the outcome. I had no idea, Alan, whether or not he was going to kill himself or not. And I could pray and I could do all the things that we do when we're afraid. But in the end, I had to trust my values rather than my habits to try to steward the situation forward properly. And I'm pleased to say that he came out of it and ended up graduating from, actually, your part of the world, LMU, in 3 years to make up for a lost year. And is just a fine young man today. But it took us imagining the possibility of not just an acceptable outcome, but something that's future perfect. The fourth element or step is the roadmap. We have to determine what is the roadmap to get from where we are to that future perfect outcome. What is the pathway and the process that we need to create that is monitorable and accountable for us to execute to get from where we are as a family, for example, to where we want to be? The fifth step is barriers. We have to look at what the barriers are that are going to potentially get in the way of us executing that roadmap, or for that matter, even creating a future perfect outcome. And those barriers can, I find, can be one of two things. They can either be an internal psycho-emotional state or external circumstances that we think are going to be barriers to being able to be successful in getting from where we are in pain to where we want to be in terms of peace and inspiration and love and mutual support.
Right.
The next step after barriers is breakthroughs. What are the breakthroughs to those barriers? How are we going to get past them? The seventh step is commitment. Is everyone involved with this problem committed to a resolution and committed to a shared resolution, even if it's uncomfortable getting there? And last is monitoring. How are we going to keep track that the roadmap is being executed and that we are all operating as expressions of our commitments and our values in moving from where we are to where we want to be? So in brief, those are the eight steps: mindset, current reality analysis, future perfect outcome, roadmap, barriers, breakthroughs, commitment, and monitoring.
Well, let me, before you go into more detail, we did get some listener questions that were emailed in, and let me ask one of them because I think it it kind of fits right in here. It says, you know, I come from a divorced family, and I have now recently gotten divorced myself, and I'm having a great difficulty raising the children at this time because myself and my ex are at a different, mindset in regards to this. How do you get two families on the same path?
Boy, it's an excellent question. Of course, whenever it comes to these sort of situations, the first thing I always do is to encourage people to seek out professional help with people that are experts in this area. So that would be, you know, a child psychologist, it might be marital counselors, it might be family therapists. I encourage people to access resources and to be bold in interviewing numerous resources to make sure they find someone to work with that can really understand them and that they connect with and that their children connect with. I think that's often overlooked. You know, that we've got to make sure that our children will open up and talk to these people. In the case of divorce, which is, of course, an endemic issue these days, seemingly in our society, and a tough one. What I find in my experience with people is oftentimes divorce can be very challenging, problematic. It can awaken a lot of kind of good, bad, right, wrong conversations, a lot of battles between the parents. But usually the parents have a shared commitment and love of the child. And so I guess my initial response would be seek out professional help with people that are experts in these areas. But if people wanted to sort of use my methodology in my book to sort of see what they could do on their own, I think it begins with communication with the ex-spouse in a way that says, look, let's set aside how you feel about me or I feel about you or what our story is, the evidence we've gathered against each other, and let's see if we can't agree that we have a higher mutual commitment of stewardship to our children. And that we both want what's best for our children. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And what I find is most times parents do. And if we can start from the premise that we share stewardship for what's best for our children's future, and instead not use our children as as sort of ammunition against one another. We can do so, I believe, again, through approaching it from a values-based perspective rather than an ego-based perspective. So I guess those would be my initial thoughts.
Well, I think that's very well put, and I have said the same thing myself, so or something similar to it. I couldn't agree more. The other thought was, as far as effective communication with our children, is there any particular secrets? I mean, is there anything that comes out? I know there were a couple things that you had in the book. What are some of the things that might be something that people haven't thought of?
Well, what I find in my work, and it's quite interesting, by the way, because most of my clients have been with me a long time, 6-7 years. And when you talk to a CEO for 6 or 7 years, what may start out as a relationship around business strategy or tactics, often they want to get into personal issues, and it ends up around family issues or substance abuse or any other personal issues they deal with. And so the reason I go into that is that when we want to kind of bridge a gap with another human being, there are tools that we're given that I think we forget to use. And I think it begins with this statement. Everybody is in their own movie all the time, and everyone else is just a walk-on player in that movie. So what does that really mean when it comes to a parent and a child? We have to remember that every human being out there, in my opinion, is operating in their own world, in their own movie. And you and I and even mom and dad are just sort of ancillary cameos in that movie. We don't know what these children are going through and the rest of the time they're not around us at school or with their friends. But clearly they have their own experience going on, their own reality. So the very first thing to do is to not require that our children join us in our movie, but rather to be so committed to their future that we earn the trust for them to invite us into their movie, to understand what they're going through and how they see reality as a very first starting point to knowing what their opinion is about life and whether they trust it or they don't trust it. As you know, child suicides and substance addiction and all sorts of issues these days are epidemic in our society, and I can't help but wonder how much of that isn't in place because children often feel like they aren't understood, and mom and dad haven't bothered to really come over into my movie and understand what I'm dealing with. They just want to lecture me on their movie and what was their experience and truth. So I think two things. One is, let's remember everyone's in their own movie and be so committed to their future that we join them in their movie rather than require that they join us in ours. And secondly, we practice communication guidelines where we ask open-ended questions, and we ask questions from an intentionality of not judging them or immediately applying punitive response, but rather really just to learn, because the real issue for us to be invited into children's movies is we have to be trustworthy to those children. And mm-hmm. we cannot be trusted in that sacred space of their movie if we're going to go in there and thrash around with judgment or response or punitive actions. It's we're almost more consultants by the time they're teenagers than we are managers. Whereas when they're younger, management is appropriate. By the time they're teenagers, biology has them desiring for independence, and in doing so, it really requires us to change our game as parents to earning the right to be trusted in their worlds. What do you think?
Well, I like that, and I love the part about the consultant, because the thing about a consultant is that when you hire one, you choose to accept or not accept that. You know, it's not a management thing they're choosing, and I like how you've put that is that they have to trust that you are, that as a consultant, you're providing the information that they need to move on, so in a positive way. So I like that. And the part about the movie I love, because it poses the perfect question that I can see any parent asking their child, and they can go do it right now. I mean, you can ask your child, tell me about what's going on in your movie. If your
right.
life, if your life was a movie, what type of movie would it be? I'd love to hear the answer. I can't wait to get home and ask. I mean... with each child is probably going to have a completely different type of movie that's going on.
Absolutely. In fact, each person does. And what we often forget as parents is that we have our own movie that somehow we believe. And by the way, this thing about movies,
yeah.
which I talk a little bit about in the book, we not only live in our own movie, most human beings, 99%, believe that their movie is the movie.
Exactly.
Spend their time doing is promoting and defending the premise that their movie is the only movie. And as a result, that's what sets us up into conflict with other human beings. But really fully committed human beings to others are people that operate out of a sense of larger stewardship and with the humility to be a learner rather than a knower, and to understand, I may not have all the answers as a father. Mm-hmm. I definitely know that I don't. But if my children sense my intentionality out of authentic love for them and unconditional love for them, that I really want the best future possible for them, even if it's not a reflection of what my experience in my movie has been, they will pick up on that, not just through my words, but by the way that I treat them and with the respect that I give them and with the respect and allowance that I give them for them to have their own movie in reality. Only then can I be trusted in that sacred space, and perhaps they'll let me know what their real challenges are so that it isn't too late for us to be able to maybe give them some input if they're willing to accept it. And then they get to make the choice at some age, and they have the consequences, but at least we keep that vital lifeline of influence and opinion into that movie where they perhaps have a little better information to work with.
You know, while you were saying that, this picture came into my mind of a teenager directing his own movie and then looking back at me and saying, okay, well, I still need to do this, 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 and this. And I go, well, you know what? As your executive director, you don't have the funds for it.
That's right. That's right. Every movie needs funding. That's exactly right. Which is often, by the way, it's a funny point, but it's a true point. Oftentimes, the very last vestige of influence we have with our children is economic. Is it not?
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right. And probably the last one is usually college, when they want to go to college. And you're looking at funding that, you know, it's something that's probably only going to happen if they have that backing.
And, you know, we just went out to our son's graduation a couple of weeks ago, and it's fascinating how these, you know, I have a theory of four stages of life. I don't know if we have time for me to share that, but I've shared this with a number of psychologists that agree that basically this is true.
Please do.
Do you have just a minute to go through that?
Absolutely.
So here's my premise, and maybe there's something in this in terms of some information of how to work with children that you know that that we love and that we're committed to trying to do the very best we can for. I believe there's four stages in life, and this is just my own amateur psychologist insight. I think stage one, a human being is born, and in that first month or so of life, they're in what I call the disempowered, undifferentiated self stage. In other words, they don't know they're a separate entity. They just react to whatever their particular environmental impact is. If they're cold, they cry. If they're hungry, they cry. When they're warm, they sleep. And they don't really know they're a separate self. And then typically 1 to 3 months, at least the information I have, they discover their hands and feet, and they can push down with their right hand and roll over. And mom and dad walk into the room and keep making this noise toward them, Alan, Alan, Alan. And you realize, I'm Alan. And so the ego is born, and phase two is entered. Phase two is compliant ego self. And which is childhood, which is just in early infancy to puberty, I believe we go through a phase of compliant ego self. Why compliant ego self? Because at that stage, we have to learn what the rules are of being a separate self in a world that isn't me. What are the rules for Alan to be a good boy rather than a bad boy, to get the carrot rather than the stick? And we learn from our parents and from our teachers and from policemen and from movies what the rules of operating as an independent self are. Then we hit puberty, and at puberty we enter phase three, which is independent, non-compliant ego self. Now, I think there's a biological imperative at level three where people naturally begin to want to feel a sense of independence, and they want to test their wings with their own values and principles and thoughts and life views, maybe out from underneath the heavy hand of those guiding parental influences or institutional influences that tell them this is the way it is. They want to test what they believe. And as a result, they start to look to what other people think about them, their peer group or their sexual attractant opposite group of how do I look good? How do I make sure that I'm acceptable in the eyes of others? Most people, Alan, in my opinion, never leave level three identity. My mother died at 76, the same insecure 14-year-old that she was in 1934. Wow. My dad died at 95, the same insecure 14-year-old he was in 1927. Most people never leave level three, this sense of separate self that is independent. The problem is, as we get into middle age and older, and this includes the parenting experience, we're often we start to find that identity of independent, non-compliant self, what do others think of me, starts to fail us, and we start to grow with self-doubt. We've gathered evidence along the way against ourselves of what's working and not working. Fortunately, there's a level four. And level four is undifferentiated values personified self. These are the people that are the high watermarks in humanity, whether you want to look at spiritual leaders, Gandhi, Christ, Buddha. If we think of those people, what did they manifest? They personified individual values of love, compassion, truth, peace, faith in the case of Mother Teresa, non-discrimination in the case of Martin Luther King. So the people that are the high watermarks of humanity have gotten to level four of personified values self. Why do I go into all that? Because our job as parents, in my opinion, ultimately, as stewards of our children's lives, is to help them realize that there is a level four and to get there.
Wow. First of all, I really like it. And it goes into enough detail that I think that people can get it and can see themselves. I mean, as you were saying it, I'm following along and I'm going, okay, I remember there. Oh yeah, I remember there. And I remember there. So I'm hoping that people can see that as you're going through it. You asked me what my thought was in the beginning before you said it, and it's similar to something that I have said to parents at times, but what I've said is much more simplistic in the sense that, and I said, I think that they're going from being totally dependent to teenage years where they're becoming incredibly independent, and our goal is to get them to become intradependent. So that they can, I don't know that that's a word, but if they can become interdependent at that point to where they can understand themselves, but they can also understand that there is a place for them to be able to interact with other people and that it isn't all about them.
Yes. And frankly, to awaken, I'm sorry to interrupt, but frankly, to awaken to a larger sense of purposefulness. What I find is maybe the key eligibility factor for happiness for human beings, which is, of course, what we want for our children, mm-hmm. is for people to be in the service of a higher sense of personal purpose than merely what others think of me or how much money I make or whether I have a good day or a bad day going. I start every program, workshop, and coaching relationship with a quote, and the quote is this: success is obtainable through mere personal effort. Significance, however, requires great personal purpose. Success doesn't always result in significance, but significance always results in success. Now, the reason I made that quote up is I believe it's a guidance system when I lose my way, or anyone I'm committed to trying to support loses their way, to remind them that we always have the option of developing a sense of personal purpose, which I think is found through our values and how to contribute those values to other people, in service to the world, and I think it's that which makes us eligible for the power to be able to trust it, to be trusted with a true success along with significance rather than having it come at the cost of our personal happiness. Thoughts?
Oh, I think that's great. I mean, that it's as you were saying that affects me right to my soul. I mean, that is how I believe, that is what I want to be able to project. That's part of the reason for even having this show. And part of the reason was that I know that there are wonderful people out there that want to give back. They want to help teach other people how they can be more significant, not only in just raising their children, but in enjoying their own life. And I love how the fact you tied it to happiness. And I've said that as well. I mean, if you want true happiness and true joy, part of what you need to be doing is not only knowing your own significance, but knowing how you can help others.
And one of the ways, by the way, in the book that I lay out a format for doing is creating a personal life vision statement. And this sounds like just a personal mission statement or something. It's much bigger than that. I frankly used it for the last 10 years to try to guide the development of my business, which has fortunately been very successful, as well as my family, particularly in the tough moments. And literally, I credit this statement that I'll share with you as an example of what, frankly, saved my oldest son's life when he was suicidal. And the statement is this: my personal life vision, Al Colleen's personal life vision, is a world where everyone realizes their fullest potential, a world of extraordinary relationships and extraordinary accomplishments, and a world where integrity and honorable actions are courageously pursued and commonly experienced. Now, what I want in that statement is to capture the idea that I want this for the world. I want every human being in the world, to the best of my ability, to get to that place I've just described, where they realize their fullest potential in all ways, spiritually, in terms of health, in terms of their relationships, in terms of their abundance and success in business, and their ability to support themselves and the people they love. We need to, in our final 5 minutes on our deathbeds, we're going to be thinking about the relationships, I believe, not necessarily how much money's in the bank.
Yep.
And so I want to have extraordinary relationships. I want them, and I want you to have them. And I want us to play big, because it's a short experience, this thing called life. It happens much quicker than we think it's going to happen as we're going through it, particularly when we're younger, another challenge children have. They think it'll be forever. We need to treat it with preciousness, that we have to play big and go for it and be bold. And last, we have to have integrity and honor, and that takes courage, particularly in the face of adversity, because I think adversity is what tests us and helps us determine where we are in those four stages of evolution that were described earlier.
Well, I hope everybody out there that's listening, you know, that they know it is time to go for it. We are talking with Al Killeen, and his book is Sole Proprietorship, The 8 Critical Steps to Overcoming Problems in Business and in Life. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in 1 minute. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back with Al Killeen, and we are talking about leadership. We are talking about management. We're talking about coaching. We're talking about critical steps to overcoming problems in your business and life. Al, speaking of leadership, share with us what leadership, management, and coaching have to do with parenting.
Well, wonderful, and thanks for bringing that up at this moment, because I was just looking during the break there at what are some of the issues I want to make sure that we get to in our limited time here. And I think this is very important to separate leadership from management, first of all. We'll get into coaching. But if you Google the term leadership, what will often show up is you'll go to various websites that will talk about management practices. And I think in this society in particular, we tend to think of leadership and management as business tools, and we tend to think of them as synonymous. They get blended together and confused. I don't believe they are. I think they're separate skill sets that go far beyond business. They're really personal skill sets that are between leadership, management, and coaching. They're three macro tools that are critical for people to be trusted with the empowerment to manifest the life they're capable of, in my opinion. Here's how they are defined in my world. Leadership is the ability to courageously envision a future unlimited by the past that others see their future in. So we take Martin Luther King. He had a dream where one day all children would be judged by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. For the people in the crowd that believed in that future, that had never happened before, but they wanted to get to that ideal future of a world where we look at each other and we really value one another based on the quality of our character rather than racial differences or national differences or gender differences or whatever. Mm-hmm. For people who believed that, he was their leader. For the people who didn't believe that, he wasn't their leader. And so leadership is about the ability to invoke in others the possibility of the future unlimited by the past and have it be something that they see as their own future, not yours, not mine, but their own. If we do that, you know, John F. Kennedy gave two speeches that he wanted a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. And it was a way to try to show the superiority of what he thought the American system was versus the Soviet system in the space race. He got killed after two speeches. But for the people in the crowd that were inspired by his vision of having a man on the moon, they followed through and had a man on the moon by the end of that decade. So leadership is about provoking greatness out of people by inspiring them to operate beyond the confines of what's comfortable. Management is the ability to create the processes, approaches, and resources to move from where you are to where you want to be in an effective, accountable, and collaborative fashion. Management's about creating the roadmap to get there and holding ourselves accountable to executing that roadmap. Coaching, on the other hand, is really is the skill of supporting people past the barriers that get in the way of their ability to become what they're capable of. So what do athletic coaches?
You look,
Tiger Woods, whoever, they all have coaches, even if they're better at the individual sport than the coach, because they know that a coach is critical to help that person get past the barriers that get in their way. How does this apply to parenting? Parents have to create a future for their children, because one of the reasons childhood depression and suicide and some of these dark substance abuse issues and whatnot are present, in my opinion, is a lot of times children lose their future. The girl breaks up with me. The boy breaks up with me. Mom and dad got divorced. I don't know what I'm going to do after college. When people lose their future, it's actually a major compelling addition to depression, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So depression exists in the absence of a future. Our job is to keep our children from getting depressed and from losing their sense of future. That's job one, is to always have a sense of inspirational future before us, even if right now we're in a tough time. Management is about helping people develop the pathways and the internal discipline and activities that allow them to be effective in whatever future it is they're going for in their life domains, and to be effective at creating an execution systematic process to getting there that they hold themselves accountable to, even when it's not fun and it's not comfortable. And right. Coaching is about being trusted in that sacred space of other human beings where we support people past those limiting perspectives that keep them from believing that they're capable of doing it. It's really about being a dust-free mirror and standing for the greatness of other human beings when they are emphasizing instead in their movie all the evidence they've gathered against themselves as to their own mediocrity and therefore lack of trustworthiness and love.
Well, yeah, and it sounds very much like what you were saying right from the beginning, is that when they're younger, we're in maybe more of a stage as a parent of management.
Yes.
But as they become teenagers, you really have to look at yourself more from the standpoint of coaching.
Yes.
But they have to be willing to accept that coaching.
Absolutely. And leadership. Absolutely.
And leadership.
I think excellent parenting for teenagers involves consulting, leadership, and coaching more than management. Why? Because level three identity has us automatically, out of our biological imperative, sort of push back when somebody tells us we have to do something. We're in a natural phase in our life where we want to test our own wings. And if we want to keep that vital connection to have influence with those we love, we have to almost earn that right by talking about the future in such a way that we can help people feel inspired toward it, our children inspired toward it. We have to coach them past those internal barriers or even circumstantial barriers that get in their way and have them convinced that they can't get there. It's through that that we create bold possibility for our children. And in doing so, we create the legacy of true love for our children as opposed to merely managerial effectiveness. Back to your earlier situation with the CEO situation.
Yep. Now let's talk about when adversity hits. In other words, we've been trying all of those things. You know, we've tried to apply the eight critical steps.
Sure.
But how do we then best handle adversity in the family, you know, at that point?
Well, my opinion is that adversity is the greatest teacher we have in life. None of us like it. None of us, I like to tell people sort of half facetiously that I came from the Munsters. You know, my family was a very dysfunctional family. And so, you know, we had a lot of adversity when I was growing up in my childhood. And what I've observed with my clients is adversity is something that visits us all. And I think we have an innate avoidance We try to avoid adversity. We try to prevent it. We try to operate as though it doesn't exist. And yet it visits us all. I mean, we all are going to experience it. And everyone we know and love is going to experience adversity lots of times in life. I believe adversity becomes the test of where we are at any given moment in life. And when we face adversity, that becomes the acid test is, am I going to respond to this out of my fear, out of my ego, out of my scarcity-mindedness, out of my anxiety, out of my own self-diminishment? Or am I going to respond to this out of faith, whatever faith means to you, out of a sense of spiritual belief that whatever that means to a person, whether religious or not, am I going to operate out of a sense that life can be trusted despite the fact that adversity is present? Am I going to be courageous? Am I going to be someone who is, whether I'm successful or not, going to give everything I can to trying to seek a positive resolution? What is it that creates that space? I believe it's a values-based commitment to a personal sense of purposefulness that goes beyond mere personality or egocentric defensiveness and promotion.
Yep. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking about people that had not gone through adversity. And I read a story many years ago about Freddie Prinze Sr., and who committed suicide at a very young age. And everybody that they interviewed close to him believed that it was because he had never gone through adversity. He had never had, a girl break up with him. He had never not been funny. He had never not been accepted. Everything he had done had turned to gold. Everything was great. And they said that when he committed suicide, it was because a girlfriend broke up with him and he had absolutely no concept of how to deal with adversity. And so your point, which I think is very well taken, is that we're all going to have it and we're all going to learn from it. It's part of life. It is part of what we're going to go through, and we should come out of it each time a little wiser.
Boy, beautiful point. And by the way, I think what you also point to that is invaluable is that if our job as parents is ultimately stewardship, which I believe it is, I don't think as Khalil Gibran said, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They came through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. And so what's being said there, I think, is stewardship. I think our job as parents is not to assume that our children are chattel, their property. They are meant to be sort of somehow validations of our experience of life. They have a right to a life onto themselves, and what's the best thing we can do as people who love them to try to help be stewards of that future? We can give them the tools to be able to deal with life effectively, a big part of which is successfully and effectively responding to adversity. So just like muscles that have to be exercised, we have to let our children experience adversity, even at a young age, despite our tendency to want to protect them. There is an argument among a lot of psychologists today that one of the reasons we have so many childhood suicides and problems we have today is that we've almost done too good of a job of giving our children a sense of artificial reality that life doesn't involve adversity. And yet, I believe that adversity becomes the great teachable moments for all of us. And if we let our children experience some of that adversity while with us and in the presence of people that love them unconditionally and are committed to them, we have an opportunity to use our experience, our wisdom, to help them develop some strategies as to how to respond to that adversity so that they don't find themselves like Freddie Prinze in a place where they find incapable of it when it does ultimately come their way.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I want to touch on a couple. We have two more questions that were emailed in from listeners. This first one is humorous to me. It starts with, "I don't mean to put down men, but..."
So you know we're in trouble already.
I knew it. When I read this, "I don't mean to put down men, but they are sometimes late to the party in becoming great listeners with their children. As protectors of the family, they also need to be approachable. What is your experience in this area?"
Well, I agree. I agree. I think men have are often scripted in this society in particular to be producers and to be productive. And of course, these days, increasingly women are as well. And women have their own challenge. I was just out at lunch recently with a a dear friend who is a CEO of a company, female, and also an excellent mother. And, you know, women have their own challenges of having to have a lot of different roles they serve. But men often are sort of allowed the premise that just go out and create the career, and that's what will define you, and you're protecting your family, you're doing good things. What I can certainly say in my own case, and in the case of many fathers that I see out there, is that there's a heavy burden that a lot of men carry because they feel a sense of guilt over where they're prioritizing their time, which is often at the office and often in the name of work to try to create the revenue for the family and all that. And that, of course, has to be done, but it's so easy along the way to forget that our children are going to grow up while we're not looking. And so I frankly agree that men are often late to the party. The question is that something to be looked at critically, or is it to be looked at as an opportunity for men to realize that it's not only appropriate, but it's critical for the sake of their own legacy and their own sense of self that they take the time to live a balanced approach to their life, and they take the time to appreciate their family and their children and to slow down and to take a day in the park with the kids and to sort of let the children be in their movie, even at a young age when men may feel like, oh, I've got to get out and get to work or go do this or that. I agree with the individual who wrote the email that this is something at the very least to be aware of so that individual males can begin to take a look at, am I prioritizing the balance of my life properly?
Well, and yeah, there's no higher purpose for us. And another question that came in says, many of my friends tell me their teens are unhappy and depressed over their lives for reasons they just don't understand. How do you suggest parents apply your 8 critical steps to deal with these kids? And we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, I think, first of all, relative to our earlier statements, I think if there's concern for children beyond the normal ups and downs or states of blues, they should seek professional help. There's a lot of good people out there that are really excellent in this area, psychologists, psychiatrists, et cetera. We've certainly exposed ourselves to that help when necessary. As far as the 8 critical step, it probably begins first and foremost with just the first step of mindset. I mean, certainly there are the other 7 steps, but if we practice the mindset and we let our children know that, look, I am unconditionally committed to your happiness. It doesn't mean that you're always going to be comfortable, and it doesn't mean there aren't going to be times you disagree with me, but I want to give you the experience that I unconditionally love you and will do whatever is necessary to make sure your life turns out as good as possible to the best of my ability. Now, I need to earn the right for you to believe me when I say that, and you can only do that through our experience together. So don't be afraid, son or daughter, to give me some coaching when I'm saying or doing things that are having you want to lock me out from your world, because I can't help you if you don't let me in. So at the very least, let's be in each other's worlds where I can trust you and you can trust me, and if there's times I get a little too heavy-handed or whatever, don't be afraid to, you know, hold up the timeout sign or whatever, because what's most important is that we have a relationship of trust. From there, the other 7 steps can be followed in a dialogue format, a project format with the children, where you can work on something mutually with them in writing, where you sit down and walk through the book and the 8 steps and help the child develop a personalized vision and reinforce their level 4 identity. Be affirming in terms of what great values and qualities these children manifest of generosity, of love, of selflessness. Reaffirm that, because people become how they are treated by others. And if we treat people as though they're broken, they will tend to live down to that. But if we treat people as though they are expressions of the light, of value, of principles, they will tend to live up to that. So I guess in 3 minutes or less, that would be my short answer.
Well, and it's beautiful because, I mean, the main crux of that, when you mentioned about being in their world, if you're not around to be in their world, why should they trust you to be in their world or to be in their movie for that matter? Now, before we're out of time, if anybody has any other questions, I mean, obviously I'm reading the book now. Where can they get the book?
There are actually lots of websites that have it, but the websites that I would encourage people to visit, the easiest one is www.8, which is the number 8, 8criticalsteps.com.
Okay.
And that will take them to my website. They can click on the book, and from there there's order forms and all. And if people order from either my website or from the 8 Critical Steps website, and they decide they want to order a book, I'd be more than happy to sign their copy when I send it to them. We're trying to get the book, Alan, into schools and into various corporations and into, you know, religious groups and all sorts of groups, because I think this is a universal template that people can use in whatever domain that they are operating.
Well, I'll tell you what, I will do everything I can to get it in there as well. I'm doing some speaking now at some schools in regards to running away in America and trying to get kids not to run away, explaining to them what happens if they get involved in gangs or human trafficking. But I would love to, when I am talking to them, to get your book in there, to have these kids reading that. I love the part about where you're telling the kids, feel free to give some feedback. If we're coming on a little strong or something, give some feedback. They need to know that.
Yes.
So again, Al, thank you for being here. I wish we had more time, and I would love to have you back on. And just if we can finish, tell us again what your personal life vision is. You said that, and I thought that was beautiful.
Well, thank you, Alan, and again, thank you for having me on. And here's my personal life vision. And by the way, I believe everybody has this within them. They have their own personal life vision. They need to create. The book will help them do so. My personal life vision is a world where all people realize their fullest potential, a world of extraordinary relationships and extraordinary accomplishments, and a world where integrity and honorable actions are courageously pursued and commonly experienced. You or any of your listeners, anybody I can help, any way that I can help them, even if it's just an email or a conversation, I'd be more than happy to. And I'm deeply honored that you've let me come on today, Alan, and bless you for the work you're doing. I think it's hugely important that people like you are out doing good work like this, because in effect, our highest obligation in life, I think, is to develop effective human beings, and the best way to do that is by making sure that we're good stewards of our children.
Well, thank you, Al, and right back at you. Keep up the good work, and again, I would really love to have you on again. Take care.
Thanks
now.
So much, Alan. Anytime.
You got it. Bye now.
Bye now. Take care.
All right. Everybody, that was Al Killeen. If you get a chance, get the book. I am reading it myself. Also, if you get a chance, go to our website, www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. If you have listeners you want to recommend, please do so. And until next week, seek to catch someone doing something good every day. I know I am.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.